This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, September 28th, 2011. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, the people of Somalia face famine and violence. We'll look at the militant group Al-Shabaab and the U.S. role in the country. Cornel West calls for support for the protesters in New York's financial district after a police crackdown. And challenges to the national healthcare law and warrantless wiretapping will preview the next session at the U.S. Supreme Court. Those stories and more. First, this news.
I'm Alice Holstein with headlines for FSRN. Israel's interior minister has approved the construction of over 1,100 homes in the contested Gilo neighborhood in East Jerusalem, a decision that may hinder international peace efforts. Leaders from around the world have criticized the announcement. Rami Amlegari reports from Gaza.
This settlement construction comes amidst U.S.-led efforts with other international major players to bring back Palestinians and Israelis to the negotiations table. Over the weekend, the Quartet for Middle East Peace, involving the U.S., United Nations, Russia, and the EU, called on both parties to resume peace talks. Palestinians had initially agreed to negotiate, but only if Israel freezes all construction on Palestinian lands. Rami Al-Mighari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
A military appeals court in Bahrain is upholding the prison sentences of 21 pro-democracy protesters. The Bahrain news agency reported today that the prisoners, 8 of whom received life sentences, were convicted of trying to overthrow the government. The ruling comes just after the Obama administration announced plans to sell $53 million worth of military equipment to Bahrain. Defense lawyers say they plan to appeal the military court's decision to the country's highest civilian court. Protesters clashed with security troops in Guinea today and yesterday, marking the 2-year anniversary of a 2009 massacre where over 150 protesters lost their lives. Salvatore Segues is Amnesty International's expert on West Africa and told FSRN what's happening on the ground.
There was a demonstration called for by two of the main opposition parties who were criticizing the way the incoming parliamentary election was being organized. And when the protesters tried to go to the point of rally, they were stopped by police who used live rounds, tear gas, and batons. And the police killed at least 3 people. And it is very disappointing that the newly elected president Alpha Condé is resorting to the same techniques.
The protesters are accusing President Condé, who won the country's first free elections last year, of rigging the upcoming parliamentary elections, which will take place sometime before the end of the year. In Chile, students are still marching and striking, but they're back at the bargaining table with government officials. Caroline Lewis has the story in Santiago.
After a 10-hour-long meeting yesterday, the Federations of University and High School Students announced their decision to rejoin the table of dialogue with the government. Chilean Parliament is currently discussing the national budget for the coming year. The statement prepared by the Confederation of Chilean University Students, or CONFECH, emphasized that they hope to influence the proposed budget for education. With the start of the spring semester, several high schools and universities that were on strike are starting to reinitiate classes. But spokesperson of CONFECH, Camila Vallejo, is calling for students to keep striking until the talks prove to be effective. A national student strike has been called for tomorrow, and several marches are planned in cities across Chile. Caroline Lewis, FSRN, Santiago.
Cantaloupes carrying the bacteria Listeria are causing the U.S.'s biggest foodborne disease outbreak in a decade. The Center for Disease Control reports 13 deaths and a total of 72 persons infected across 18 states, with the most infections in Texas, Oklahoma, Colorado, and New Mexico. They have traced the source to the Rocky Ford brand cantaloupes from Jensen Farms in Granada, Colorado. The farm has issued a voluntary recall. The Center for Science in the Public Interest says that melons have caused at least 36 disease outbreaks since 1990, and greater regulation of the industry is needed. Government documents just released under the Freedom of Information Act shed light on how the FBI chooses to place individuals on the terrorism watch list and how long they're kept there. Ginger McCall of the Electronic Privacy Information Center helped obtain the documents and explains what they reveal.
The documents suggest that a hunch or a suspicion is not enough to put someone on the list, which is good. They formally embody that concept. However, there are some things in the documents that are very troubling, including the fact that even after you are acquitted or your case is dismissed in a court of law, you can still be included on the list. There was also a term that we found to be a little odd. For inclusion on the list, the standard is reasonable suspicion, and the way that you get reasonable suspicion is particularized derogatory information, and that's a term we've not heard anywhere before. It's not defined anywhere in these documents, and we just wonder what it means.
The list currently has about 42,000 names, including about 8,000 Americans. About 16,000 people, including 500 Americans, are barred from flying. And that's headlines for FSRN. From Washington, D.C., I'm Alice Olstein.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. The U.S. Supreme Court has some high-profile cases coming before it as it kicks off its new session next week. They include a challenge to the federal health care law and a review of warrantless wiretapping as well as GPS surveillance. Matt Laszlo has the details from Washington.
The Obama administration has now asked the Supreme Court to decide the constitutionality of the nation's new health care law. Some legal experts think the administration could be asking for a ruling in order to give states more certainty about the law as governors work to implement its key provisions by 2014. Stephen Shapiro of the American Civil Liberties Union says the administration also might want to argue the case itself in case President Obama is ousted next year.
I think the decision always was a political one. Did they want the court to decide health care before the election or after the election?
As for Shapiro's admittedly unscientific prediction on the final ruling,
I actually believe that if the court reaches the merits, they're going to uphold the statute and say it is the mandate and say it is within the authority of Congress. And I think it will be by more than a 5-4 vote.
The ACLU hasn't drafted a formal opinion on the health care law yet, but their lawyers are involved in some other suits which they laid out Wednesday at the National Press Club, including a warrantless wiretapping case. The Bush administration initially carried out the program without congressional authority, but in 2008, Congress granted sweeping powers to survey foreign communications with U.S. citizens. In the past, the ACLU had its challenge thrown out because numerous courts ruled the organization wasn't affected by the surveillance, so it wasn't granted standing. But now numerous media agencies and lawyers have teamed up with the organization to challenge this law. Attorney Jamil Jaffer is working on the case and says it would be a dangerous precedent if the court didn't grant them standing because they can't prove the government intercepted their communications.
That leaves very few people who can challenge government surveillance. And in the case of the FAA, a statute like the FISA Amendments Act, which is a foreign intelligence statute that is designed to operate in secrecy, in secret, the set of people who can challenge it is literally a zero set. There's nobody in the world who knows for a fact that their communications have been acquired under the FAA.
Arizona's controversial immigration law is also before the court. Five other states now have similar laws that allow police officers to demand papers from suspected undocumented immigrants. Omar Jawat, who works on immigration rights, argues it's a basic question of federalism.
It's whether states and cities can basically overrule or veto federal immigration policy by creating their own systems to identify, arrest, detain, and punish those that they decide are illegal aliens.
Another case involves whether law enforcement officials can use GPS devices to monitor the movements of suspected criminals. The case hinges on the Fourth Amendment, which guarantees protection from unreasonable searches and warrants being used without probable cause. Shapiro explains the government's case.
The government's brief suggests that there is no Fourth Amendment issue here because the moment that you get into the car, you have exposed your behavior to the public, and once you have exposed your behavior to the public, you are forfeited all constitutional privacy.
But Shapiro and the ACLU argue the government needs to adapt how it views the Fourth Amendment to modern times.
In the 21st century digital age, we can no longer think of privacy as a binary system with an on-off switch in which either things are totally shielded from anybody's observation and entitled to constitutional protection, or exposed to the eyes of even one person and therefore open and fair game and outside the protections of the Fourth Amendment entirely.
That GPS case is set to be argued in front of the Supreme Court November 8th. Matt Laszlo, FSRN, Washington.
In New York City's financial district, the Occupy Wall Street protests have entered the 12th day of an encampment in Zuccotti Park, or Liberty Plaza. The resistance movement deliberately does not have a designated leader, but holds General Assembly meetings daily to discuss how to change what protesters view as a corrupt financial system in the United States. Yesterday, prominent author and civil rights activist Dr. Cornel West visited the protests and spoke with FSRN's Kelly Benjamin about why he supports the actions.
Where do you see this movement going?
Well, right now it's just such a beautiful thing, and the flowering and the flourishing of it is unpredictable. But most important, you can feel the flow, you can feel the momentum. And that's the crucial thing right now. Step by step, stage by stage, feeling the momentum, more and more people coming, more and more people hearing about it, bringing people together, all walks of life, all different colors, all different orientations, but saying we got to take a stand against the corrupt Wall Street oligarchs who've been squeezing all the juices out of the democratic experience.
Do you think this has the potential to go viral and spread across the country?
Oh, Lord, yes. No doubt about that. No doubt about that, and that's what I'm hoping.
What do you think the end result needs to be from all of this?
The end result needs to be that the elites who disproportionately rule are going to have to acknowledge that our voices may not be as strong through the electoral political system, but it's strong from the streets. Very strong from the streets. Oh, yes. Definitely. You see, this is the legacy of Brother Martin, too, though. You know what I mean? We got to put it in some historical context, man. That brother's smiling from the grave. He's been weeping for a long time.
One thing that I see is notably absent here is the members of the clergy. Why do you think that is?
That's a good question. See, I don't know. I don't know. If they start bringing out some of their congregation, you got something going right there, I'm telling you. Now, of course, Union Theological Seminary, Serene Jones and Gary Dorian and James Cone, all of those liberation theologians and prophetic folks, their hearts are here. There's no doubt about it. And they've probably come through just individually and then went back to work or something. But you're right. I didn't realize there's not a strong clergy presence as of yet.
So have you been down here before? Is this your first time down here?
No, it's the first time. I was on the Martin Bashir show last week, and I mentioned it. I said, brothers and sisters down on Wall Street have my heart. But I had to come in, and I jumped on a plane and left right back. I just got off a plane. I got another 7:30 thing. I said, I got to come here.
What do you think the people in middle America should be thinking about this right now? What should they take away from this?
They should first see courage. They should see vision. They should see this represents the best of the country, the best of the country's history. And they have to shatter the stereotypes. The great Howard Zinn. We just did a tribute to Brother Howard Zinn in Washington. He said, dissent is the highest form of patriotism.
That was Dr. Cornel West speaking to FSRN's Kelly Benjamin last night at the Occupy Wall Street protests in New York City. Latinos make up half of the Los Angeles County population, but hold a majority in only one of five districts on the County Board of Supervisors. Two rival plans aim to add another Latino majority district, but after a contentious board meeting on Tuesday night, the board opted to stick with the status quo. Now federal courts could step in, as they did 20 years ago when they found that the board failed to comply with the Voting Rights Act. Then the courts created the first majority Latino district, but consensus on the measure is far from being reached. FSRN's Dan Fritz reports from Los Angeles.
The county boardroom saw what could be the largest turnout in decades, as hundreds of constituents packed the meeting to voice their opinions of the redistricting plans.
Pues ya podemos ver que no están listos para escuchar la voz latina, la voz hispana, aquí en esta audiencia, aquí en este gobierno.
Resident Rosalio Munoz told the board that it's evident they're not ready to hear the Latino voice, because racism still exists on the board. Munoz's passion was echoed by hundreds of others, including elected officials. Bob Archuleta is mayor pro temp of Pico Rivera.
In the county of Los Angeles, we have so many Latinos that are asking for fairness and equality and a fair shot. And I think Gloria Molina's plan, T1, will do that.
Democratic Supervisor Gloria Molina was the lone voice of dissent when, after a closed-door session, four of the five county supervisors voted to approve a plan that does not add another Latino majority district. Molina occupies a district that was created 20 years ago by a federal court decree after the county board then refused to add the first Latino-majority district. But many also spoke passionately against the plans to create a new Latino-majority district. They said it would divide some communities currently grouped together and disrupt business and environmental protection efforts. Marianne Lutz is mayor of the city of Monrovia.
We have already endured some of this from the state and the federal realignment. In fact, unfortunately, our city has been split in half due to the federal realignment. One of your options before you today, T1, would split Monrovia separate from, first it would move us to a new district, and it would separate us from our unincorporated area.
Downey City Council member Mario Guerra told the board that Latinos do not all vote the same way.
I'm insulted that anybody would suggest that in our particular city on there that we vote by the color of the skin or somebody's surname. I was elected to represent the community regardless of my last name.
Representatives with MALDEF, the Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund, say they will take the issue to a federal court. The fight over the redistricting map has exacerbated political and racial divisions in communities across the county. Democratic Supervisor Mark Ridley Thomas, a former state legislator and the first black man ever elected to the county board, supports the creation of a new Latino-majority district. But he eventually changed his vote to side with the other supervisors, two white male Republicans and a white male Democrat. Representatives of some Asian American communities supported the status quo map because they feared the upheaval would decrease the political power their communities have already built in the county. Dan Fritz, FSRN, Los Angeles.
The crisis in the Horn of Africa continues, with aid agencies warning that 750,000 people are at risk of dying by the end of the year. In addition to lack of food, many are also contending with disease, including malaria, measles, and pneumonia. The famine is compounded by the armed conflict in Somalia, making it difficult for aid to reach people. Earlier this summer, the militant group Al-Shabaab withdrew from Mogadishu, but the capital is still war-ravaged, and militants still have a strong presence in other areas. We're going to take an in-depth look at Somalia today, including the U.S. role in the country. But first, we examine how the famine has affected Al-Shabaab's power in the country. FSRN's Mohamed Youssef begins our coverage.
After the UN declared famine in Somalia, Al-Shabaab reversed a decision to allow aid agencies into areas under their control. Over the last few weeks, tensions have risen as virtually no aid is reaching people in areas under Al-Shabaab's control. Al-Shabaab members arrested clan elders who tried to persuade the group to allow in aid or let people venture on their own to get food in government-controlled areas and neighbouring countries Kenya and Ethiopia. In response, clan militias have started attacking Al-Shabaab fighters. Nairobi-based political analyst Abdulwahab Sheikh Abdi Samad says Al-Shabaab leaders are divided on how to respond to the ever-worsening humanitarian crisis.
They fail to read the mood of the people. They fail to respond to the needs of the people. They fail to respond to the crisis in that particular areas. So when they block the aid entering to the Al-Shabaab control areas, people know they're saying enough is enough. That also has divided them. Some people, they publicly left from Al-Shabaab.
Abdi Samad say that the mass movement of people facing starvation and leaving Al-Shabaab areas is making it difficult for the militant group to recruit youth. It is still resorting to kidnapping children and recently gave weapons and cash as a prize to youth who participated in a Quran competition. Mogadishu's mayor, Mohamed Noor, has called on civilians to revolt against Al-Shabaab.
People have to stop fearing and fight for their protection. We are telling people to fight against Al-Shabaab and rise up against them. It is better to die while fighting or they will kill you in horrible ways.
Some have criticized the mayor and other government officials for preventing aid workers from going into areas controlled by Al-Shabaab. In mid-September, government forces arrested Turkish humanitarian workers who were attempting to deliver food. Officials say they are trying to protect foreigners until they control more parts of the country. Paddy Ankunda is a spokesperson for the African Union.
Since the Al-Shabaab fled the city, we've taken over a number of other key places. The city is too big for the soldiers that we have at the moment, so we had anticipated that it would take about 12,000 soldiers, and we just have 9,000, so we need more.
Although Al-Shabaab has left Mogadishu, few people have returned to their homes. Some are concerned the insurgent group is blending into the population and fear revenge attacks following a wave of kidnappings and beheadings of people they accuse of spying for the government. But Al-Shabaab might also be weakening due to an internal rift between its more nationalist leader Abu Mansur Robo and a more global jihadist leader Mukhtar Abu Zubair. Again, Somali analyst Abdi Samad.
Abu Zubair, normally pursue what they call a global jihadist agenda. Normally, they like to have an orders what they call from Al-Qaeda. Pro is a moderate guy. He has a sympathy a lot with localists. Then that's what they call a conflict of interest between those who pursue the global jihadist and those who consider the local ones.
More than half of Al-Shabaab fighters come from Bai and Bakool regions, where Robo has strong support. Some speculate that Robo withdrew all his fighters from Mogadishu after a misunderstanding with Abu Zubair about how they should respond to the famine in areas under their control. Many of the Somalis affected are from his own clan, and Robo's community was pressuring him to find a solution to the crisis. Abdi Samad says Al-Shabaab's Al-Qaeda-inspired tactics, like suicide bombings and beheadings, as well as ban on music and watching soccer, have isolated the fundamentalist group.
They're no longer popular now. You know, initially Eritrea was publicly helping them. Eritrea now, they got a lot of pressure from the international community. That's why Isaiah Fouke, he went to Uganda, he met with Museveni, he got advice from him. So where are they going to get some money now? Al-Shabaab, now they've been isolated, internationally even, regionally even.
Some observers say a weakening of Al-Shabaab gives the US-backed transitional federal government a better opportunity to bring stability to the war-torn country. A recent UN-brokered consultative meeting held in Mogadishu established four major benchmarks to aid the transition, improving security, drafting a constitution, national reconciliation and good governance. Critics have raised concerns about the process, citing a lack of representation of the anti-Al-Shabaab paramilitary group Ahlus Sunnah Wal Jama'a and of leaders from the self-declared independent state Somaliland. Mohammed Yusuf, FSRN.
With an expanding U.S. presence in Somalia, some groups have raised questions over reports of the U.S. role in detention and interrogation in Mogadishu and a rise in drone attacks throughout the region. For more, we turn to Rahal Walla. He's Advocacy Counsel for the Law and Security Program with Human Rights First, a nonpartisan organization based in New York and Washington, D.C. Rahal Walla, welcome to FSRN.
Thank you.
First, the executive order signed by President Obama in January 2009, right after his inauguration, set out guidelines for interrogation and detention policies. Now, your group, Human Rights First, along with seven other rights groups, has sent a letter to President Obama. What are your primary concerns and what are you hoping to get from him, especially regarding Somalia?
Well, our concerns are several-fold. First and foremost, our concerns are that the United States and the CIA in particular may be involved in directly interrogating and detaining individuals in Somalia under conditions that may violate international law. There was a recent report in The Nation magazine that essentially alleged that detainees are not treated properly by the individuals who are detaining them, and that also the United States government is involved in these interrogations and detention.
You mention one report that has come out about a prison in Mogadishu that came out in The Nation magazine, and it was reported by Jeremy Scahill, who visited Mogadishu. At the time, he spoke to FSRN, and he described conditions at the facility, which is within the airport compound in the city.
There are people that are literally losing their mind there, some of whom have been held for a year and a half without charge or access to any lawyers or Red Cross, and that they never see the light of day. Many of the people that are held there are believed to have some connection to the Islamic militant group Al-Shabaab, which has close ties to Al-Qaeda. And the U.S. CIA and potentially military intelligence personnel that work with the Somalis in that facility are permitted to interrogate prisoners when they want.
Rahawala, your response to that description?
I think that, you know, that description is exactly what troubles us. That description of how detainees in the prison in Somalia are being treated is not consistent with the requirements under international human rights law. Detainees need to be treated humanely. The executive order that the Obama administration signed required that the CIA, which was previously abusing detainees in the name of counterterrorism operations, be taken out of the detention and interrogation business. And the executive order further required that the United States take measures to provide the International Committee of the Red Cross access to detainees to help ensure that detainees are being treated humanely. So certainly Jeremy's reporting raises a lot of questions regarding whether the United States is in compliance with the law.
You also mentioned the issue of rendition. That's when U.S. government sends suspected terrorists to other countries, and in the past that has led to torture in those places. Now, supposedly President Obama closed the CIA black sites. In your letter to President Obama's office, you say that his administration has yet to articulate a policy to govern such rendition that's consistent with U.S. and international law. Where does that stand right now?
Well, what ended up happening was the Obama administration came into office and was concerned about the way that renditions were carried out under the Bush administration, so-called extraordinary renditions or transfers to torture. The Obama administration, however, did not decide to end the practice of renditions, but instead took on a study of policy and went forward to issue recommendations governing how renditions will occur in the future. However, we have not been able to see the policy that is currently in place right now. So we are, you know, asking the government to provide additional information regarding the precise regulations that are in place to govern these renditions.
So that's an important distinction. You're saying that in the Obama administration's policy as of now, it's not clear that rendition flights or the practice of rendition has stopped.
It's not clear, no.
There's also the issue of just an expanding military presence around the region there. There's expanding drone attacks in the region. Over the weekend, U.S. drone crashed into the southern city of Kismayo, according to Reuters, and Washington Post has reported on the U.S. setting up a new base in Ethiopia from which drones can be launched and an increase in drone attacks. Talk about the importance of the region right now, of Somalia and U.S. involvement there.
You know, I think the issue of drone attacks or targeted killings is a very important one, and one which has not received enough attention, especially in the United States. Targeted killing operations are incredibly sensitive, and they need to be conducted in accordance with the rule of law. What is worrisome is that we're seeing, in practice, evidence to suggest that there's an expansion of the armed conflict and the use of military force without a corresponding ability for the human rights community and the broader public to actually participate in a dialogue regarding whether this is lawful or necessary to actually counter terrorism.
And finally, I know you've sent that letter to the Obama administration on September 20th. Any response as of yet?
We actually sent it on September 6th. We made the letter public on the 20th. We have not received a response as of yet.
Rahawala is Advocacy Counsel for the Law and Security Program with Human Rights First. He joined us to speak about U.S. involvement in Somalia. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Thanks for listening today. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.